again, folks. This is The Minefield. Welcome to the show. It's wonderful to have your company as we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life, or at least try to identify what it is that's going on, what deserves attention, what doesn't. And I begin that way because I feel like that's kind of what this show is. I have this sense that something really seismic happened last week that got a bit of attention, but not that much, as we spoke about, I don't even know what we were talking about as a society last week, but it wasn't this as much as it perhaps should be. What am I talking about? Don't ask me. My co-host will explain all that. Waleed Ali is my name. His name is Scott Stevens, and he has the details.
Isn't that nice? What we should have been talking about is this, with a nice big capital T. Isn't that lovely?
Yeah, and the thing is, everything I just said, I could say without having a single idea what you're about to say right now.
It is true. And as a matter of fact, you don't have any idea what I'm just about to say.
Well, I thought I had some idea, but maybe I don't.
Maybe.
Most weeks, it turns out I didn't. So, sure, go for it.
Okay, so here's something that it's been really the substance of a lot of conversations that we've had on the show and off. And I've been struggling a little bit, Waleed, with the best way of kind of wrapping my arms around it. But I think the best way of framing it is something like this, that the logic that determines mass culture and the peculiar nature of politics are fundamentally incompatible with one another.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, yes, you may well want to challenge that, but I do think they operate...
I just want to understand it first. What do you mean?
They operate under fundamentally competing assumptions. It's not to say that politics is all grave and serious and it's only ever about weighty things and it's got all the time that it needs, whereas mass culture is necessarily more frivolous and rapid fire. I mean, something that Michael Ignatieff, for instance, wrote quite beautifully in his political memoirs about his time as a failed politician in the Canadian Parliament was that politicians, however much they might want to deny it, are slaves to fortuna. They are slaves to fortune. And so one of the skills that goes into being a good politician is being able to navigate, to negotiate the vagaries of misfortune, time, as it throws up things that you couldn't have anticipated. And he, for instance, says that one of the reasons he was a failed politician was because he thought he had more time than he actually had. So, there is a kind of there's an overlap to be sure, but I think in a very real way, mass culture and politics need to be kept far more separate than they are at the moment. And what we've been witnessing repeatedly, you could argue, say, over the last 5 or 10 years, I think we've seen it, a kind of accelerated version of it over the last 18 months. We've seen the way in which politics and mass culture have ended up bleeding into one another. They've invaded or infected one another's realms. So as a way of demonstrating, let's think about how this year has kind of begun politically. I thought last week was a really, and you flagged this already, was a really interesting week politically. I mean,
I would go further than interesting. I think it could be hugely consequential.
Yes.
It's just that very few people seem to notice.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. So, I mean, there's some obvious things here. Let's just note, for instance, that both the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition, in quite remarkable terms, staked their place in the ground. They laid out their competing political visions for the year. For instance, Bill Shorten used his press club address to kickstart, or to attempt to kickstart, a fresh national conversation about society's moral obligation to provide a living wage.
Our goal should be a real living wage, effectively raising the pay of all Australians, particularly the 2.3 million who depend upon the minimum rates in the awards.
By contrast, the Prime Minister on Insiders on the weekend reasserted, and it was really quite interesting language, wasn't it, Waleed? He reasserted the unchanging laws of economics as a way of making his case for a company tax cut.
The laws of supply and demand have not been suspended. You know, the first Labor leader to deny this economic reality is Bill Shorten. You've got to go back to Gough Whitlam's era.
That was Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull speaking with Barry Cassidy on Sunday.
It's amazing because it's so stark.
Yeah.
And so familiar, so classical. Is that a word that's appropriate to use?
Absolutely.
Here? Like, I feel like this is what politics has been meant to be about and has been about for most of my sentient life, and yet ceases to be about now. So that when this comes, you know, we've spent however many decades talking about how there's no ideological difference between the parties anymore. These are two shades of the same thing. Voters don't really have a choice. You get these protest parties emerging because of that. Politics shifts over to culture. That last part is absolutely true. Politics has shifted over to culture in a huge way now. If you compare the way that this conversation, which is moving us back onto the classical terrain of politics, where economics and different economic worldviews and the relationship of that to society and the good life are at the heart of politics, that that is the center of the ideological contest that is now re-emerging between these two parties. If you compare the lack of interest and the lack of excitement that generated compared to, say, the debates over Australia Day, or even the big story from last week, which I don't deny was a big story, but is a different kind of story, about the papers that wound up in a second-hand cabinet that was sold at something that kind of looks and smells like a garage sale, which is quite funny. If you compare the fury that surrounded that to the almost tepid response that surrounded this classical rearticulation of the borders, the boundaries, the divisions between these two parties, it's telling, isn't it? It's like we really have entered a new era of politics, such that earlier eras of politics can't be revived, or at least not easily.
Even if you just wanted to stick with the cabinet documents themselves, what was contained in them, I thought, was remarkably consequential. I mean, it was in fact quite scandalous. The one, of course, that really grabbed my attention was deliberate advice provided by the then Minister for Immigration to ASIO to delay the application process of certain irregular arrivals so that they would be caught up in forthcoming legislation that would see them only ever move to temporary protection visas. I mean, it was even the substance of the documents themselves that got missed amid the absurdity of where these documents were found and then what the fallout was. And I guess that's something that really troubles me, Waleed, on all sorts of levels, that what we've become obsessed with in so much of our political attention is the absurdity. I mean, Sheldon Wolin, one of the truly great political theorists who died 4 or 5 years ago, one of the things that he, I thought, observed very beautifully was the difference between political action and change. Change is just spectacle. Change is about movement and absurdity and conflict and debate that doesn't tend to go anywhere, and scandal and rumor and gossip. Whereas genuine political action should have a kind of either retrogressive, it should go back to a certain tradition, or it should have a certain progressive dimension to it. There really should be changes and modifications that take place as the result of a political community trying to achieve justice. And yet what we've done is substituted sound and color, if you like, for the sorts of things that really ought to be preoccupying us in common. And I just wonder, and maybe I'm fully happy for you to take me to task on this, but I just wonder if the extent to which politics itself has become a form of entertainment, the way that politics has become intermingled in our news feeds, on our news pages, in our social media streams, the way in which the true, the trivial, and the manufactured have become so intermingled that it's almost as if the reading habits and the habits of limited attention that have become cultivated in a social media and entertainment-based age, if that hasn't so infected our capacity to pay attention to things that really do matter, that all we can then become obsessed with, all we can then notice, are those things that titillate, those things that really are about sound and color.
Yeah, and that are easy to get hold of. You've put me in a bind here because I really wanted to get through this, at least this part of the show, without mentioning Donald Trump. But it's hard to avoid now because
there's a reality television star in White House.
This is a really significant point, and this is not a point about Trump. This is a point about media.
That's right.
So I think one of the great ironies of the Trump phenomenon has been the way in which mainstream media acts in an utterly appalled way at the things he says and he does and the stunts that he pulls and the way that he misleads, but is always highly entertaining. At the same time, you saw all those analyses that came out ahead of the US election, the year before last now, isn't it? It's 2018, showing the dollar amount equivalent of free coverage that he got as a result. In other words, what I mean by that is Trump is not an aberration that offends media sensibilities, although he is at a very superficial level. He's successful precisely because he is the candidate that more than any other candidate in the history of politics, probably anywhere, obeys the logic of media.
That's right.
Obeys media sensibilities, conforms to those things, is perhaps formatted to work best within the logic that mainstream media and then, of course, online media, digital media, puts before us. In other words, if you were trying to design a political candidate or a politician to work in this age, Donald Trump is very close to what you would get if you were doing it in a factory.
Yeah.
He is endlessly entertaining. He is more or less immune to the kind of analyses that dig into detail and boring kind of substance that once upon a time might have filled broadsheet newspapers. He works brilliantly in an environment where you don't pay attention to those particular things, or at the very least, you don't put weight on those things because you don't have a hell of a lot of effort. And you are constantly able to grab attention by saying and doing things that are spectacle. He is a candidate of spectacle. And so to make this not about Trump, I think what is significant is that the same is true in our domestic politics. When you look at the way that last week played out, you're right. The cabinet papers was an extraordinary spectacle, and it absorbs a lot of attention. A debate about the nature of wage stagnation, what causes it, and what should be done about it, whether this is something that should be left more or less to classical economics and the laws of supply and demand that are somehow immutable on the one hand, or this is something that now requires intervention and some kind of reassertion of politics on the other, that sort of debate, there is no spectacle there. That's two boring men in suits making very boring speeches before relatively boring crowds broadcast on more or less boring platforms. And so it cannot stand at the same time. The questions that raises about what politics then looks like, or not what it looks like, what politics is, like what politics can be about. That if politics becomes a form of entertainment or a form of mass culture, to pick up the theme of the intermingling of these two cultural logics, then I'm not sure what the purpose of it is at that point.
And look, I really do want to discuss what politics is for, what it is in fact about. But can I just add as a footnote, though, that one of the things that needs to be implicated in that is what is the function of political journalism? Because I think one of the things that we really did see in 2016 is that there were two conceits. They were mutually reinforcing. They were mutually debasing. And I think ultimately they're mutually corrupting. Those two conceits were that Donald Trump is brilliant for news copy. Whether it be websites or...
And profitable.
Yeah. And profitable. Or legacy newspapers or languishing cable networks or whatever. Donald Trump is great for news companies. Therefore, you can give him wall-to-wall coverage and that can only be profitable. That can only be good for the news channels themselves. And at the same time, the other conceit was all of our mechanisms, all of the tools that we use to read the cultural mood are telling us that there is no way in hell that Donald Trump can be elected. Therefore, we can give him wall-to-wall coverage, that's the first conceit, and he can never be elected, that's the second conceit, therefore we can do this in an amoral manner. We can do it with impunity. And I think the fact that we've now then, I mean, after a brief hiatus, I thought there was a good 6 months last year where there was a fair degree of self-criticism on the part of some news outlets that really did try to scrutinize and interrogate the culture that had allowed, the institutional culture that had allowed this to happen. After that, it seems that we've now gone fully back to the kind of spectacle of Trump and all of his minions, most beautifully and I think horrifically instantiated in Michael Wolff's little piece of human waste that's become a multi-million copy seller. And yet it's the... anyway, so I just think we've failed to learn the very lessons that were staring us in the face at the end of 2016. And I just fear that the inexorable logic of mass culture is now beginning to reassert itself on the culture and climate of political journalism as
you
well.
You can't change the grammar of the way we engage in politics without changing the grammar of politics
itself.
This is The Mindfield. You can catch the show anytime by subscribing to the podcast, by listening on the radio when it is live, if you like, or by listening on the ABC Radio app. Scott.
Yes. Our guest What can be said for our guest? He's actually one of our favorites. We've had him on the show a few times.
You know, we've had him on so many times. Don't bother introducing him. Just, he's here. Everyone
knows him. Gideon Haigh. Now, look, Gideon writes like an angel. That's the reason he's on the show. He's a Melbourne-based writer. He usually spends his time doing sports and business. He's written beautifully, however, on politics. And it just strikes me he is one of the most perceptive and insightful diagnosticians of our modern age. Gideon, thanks for coming back onto the show.
Having not expected to get an introduction, I get a very nice one. Thank you very much, Scott.
I tried to stop him, Gideon. I tried.
So, Gideon, the reason we wanted you to come on is because of the blistering critique, and one of the very few, I thought, really worthwhile reviews of Michael Wolff's book, The Fire and the Fury, that was recently published in the Australian Book Review. I'm tempted not to put a question to you at all, except to invite you to say, what does the success of Wolff's book, but also the extent to which the media has fawned all over it, talk about giving it free wall-to-wall coverage in exactly the same way that it did Trump in 2016? I mean, what does this say about the tendencies, the logic of the modern media environment?
Well, I mean, I reviewed it for Australian Book Review just simply as a professional journalist. You know, I had my workman's hat on. I looked upon it as an act of tradesmanship. And, you know, apart from the execrable prose and the vague sourcing and the general kind of disingenuousness of the exercise, I was repelled by the book's sheer frivolousness and vacuity, the lack of any sense that these were life and death issues rather than an episode of I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of the White House. I mean, there have been gossipy diaries of political intrigue before, which I've enjoyed, but this was just a stupid book about stupid people involved in a kind of a stunt presidency. And the real-world consequences of Trumpism were never addressed. Everything was explained, as you were commenting before, even to a degree pardoned by the popularity of the show. It sold. It rates. I mean, in any given week, the Trump White House throws up hosts of issues with immediate everyday impacts, not just, you know, tax and healthcare and immigration, but things like the slashing of public housing provision, the stripping of environmental protections, the defunding of preventative measures for infectious diseases. Oh, a favourite recent story of mine was reading that payday lenders have won such deregulation of their services in the US that they're celebrating by holding their annual retreat at a Trump golf club. Now, it's not that these issues don't get reported. They do. But in Wolff's conception of the universe, such consequences are of no significance. And last week it was the ludicrous credulity of the coverage of Trump's State of the Union address, you know, as to whether he looked presidential based on the fact that he didn't wear his Make America Great trucker hat. People are conditioned to this idea that at some stage Trump will pivot, whereas in fact what he does is he pivots constantly and just ends up corkscrewing into the ground. And stories kind of ricochet around until they've deposited their fragments everywhere. Every fact, whether it's true or alternative, ends up being treated with similar weight. I guess you could say, though, that I'm not sure this is a phenomenon entirely confined to the last 5 or 10 years. A book I often go back to is Daniel Boorstin's The Image, where he created the idea of the pseudo-event. He pointed out that news cycles are not regular. They don't produce a uniform quantity of event on every day, and these have to be broken up by pseudo-events, speeches, openings.
Slow news days means you have to intervene with things.
Exactly.
That are,
right. Yeah. Facsimiles designed to be reported and reproduced and to kind of provide a distraction from the tedium of life. But at the same time, we've sort of celebrated that also. Part of the culture has worshipped the kind of people who are responsible for the inner workings, the inner trappings of politics. Going back to Theodore White's The Making of a President, we fetishized the manufacture of political image and message as the clever thing to do. And we make them into gurus when we approve. You know, look at the way in which James Carville and George Stephanopoulos trotted out as, you know, these masterminds in the war room. And we deplore them as Svengalis when we don't approve, whether it's Karl Rove or it's Peter Mandelson. We even gave these people their own show, The West Wing, which kind of gives us this sort of voyeuristic frisson, enhanced by the fact that the sense that these people are the good guys. And the fact is that they appeal to journalists because their works are easy to evaluate. When you fixate, to fixate on people and image actually requires minimal expertise to interpret. It's merely a matter of opinion. And of course, opinions are like arseholes. Everyone has one. And we sort of ape democratic forms at the same time by fetishizing elections through mass opinion polling, where every policy is turned into a pitch for votes to be won or lost. And we end up with a kind of politics being reported as sport. How it plays, the symbolism it seeks, and the popularity it attains seem to preclude consideration of long-term consequences, even assuming that journalists were capable of providing it. It would be interesting to see how we covered politics if there were no polls to give us a kind of instant feedback or scorecard.
Mm. It reminds me, everything you're saying reminds me of that quote that might even be misattributed to Eleanor Roosevelt, but has haunted me ever since I heard it, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Gideon and Scott, but this idea that great minds discuss ideas and average minds discuss events and small minds discuss people. And when you stop and think about that and then think about what you discuss in your life, that's quite depressing. But but when you stop and think about what it is that our public modes of communication discuss, it becomes infinitely more depressing. Because I think you can, where I would disagree with you is not that this has no precursors, but that this isn't a particularly sharp phenomenon recently.
Sure.
I mean, because if you think about even as recently as the 2007 election, where something like work choices is at the forefront of that, there are the shadows, or you know, the ghosts of a really serious ideological contest about the purpose of life and the role of work within life in that discussion. And I know it gets boiled down to a question of legal rights, but there was something beneath that. There was a moment where Kevin Rudd said, you know, people are not mere units of production or whatever it is. That language is more or less gone now, as evidenced by last week and the absence of any serious political discussion.
Well,
about
is that because there was an opportunity in 2007, a sort of a pause to reflect rather than a necessity to kind of feed the social media beast?
Well, that's my point.
Surely this has got to come back to social media, doesn't it? Social media is...
But the interaction of traditional media with social media, and the way in which traditional media has begun taking on the logic, the grammar of social media.
Social media is brilliant at diffusing a message, but I think it also invites skepticism by seeming to trivialise everything that it touches, kind of reducing it to a slogan. Slogans have their place, but they're never more than beginnings. And at times it seems we want to pick the slogan apart rather than actually interrogate the argument.
Yeah. I think that's because the slogan is an immediately accessible thing that we think represents something. But if all you ever do is engaged at that level, you forget what's being represented.
Yes, yeah. And something like, say, Black Lives Matter invites the inevitable rejoinder that, well, all lives do.
Yeah.
So what should open a conversation actually ends up closing it.
Scott, we have 2 minutes left, and I'm aware that you haven't said that much since Gideon's joined us.
Oh, no, I'm just...
I also know that 2 minutes is a pointless amount of time to give
you. Yes, and usually I'm just clearing my throat over that.
Yeah, at that point. But is there anything you would like to say?
Indeed. Well, look, could I flag that I really do think that something we ought to be discussing very, very, very soon are the responsibilities of political journalists themselves. Because it wasn't that long ago. I mean, I note, for instance, that Daniel Boorstin's book from 1962, that is right at the beginning of the introduction of Madison Avenue admin into the White House. That's at the very beginning of the very intentional process of image manufacturing. But it really was in the decade following that, with the revelation of the Pentagon Papers, this bipartisan process, this period of overt deception, that I thought brought the best out of the media. And I'd even say, though, that it was then Watergate, with its addiction to the spectacle, in many respects, that brought the worst out of the media. It actually transformed journalism into this kind of opposition impermanence and a counterpower within politics. And what was sacrificed there was the proper notion that political journalists and representative politicians serve the same ends. They serve the same goal within the common life. That, I think, is where it was what we're fundamentally missing in our preoccupation, our post-Watergate preoccupation with the spectacle.
So Scott's throat is now cleared, and he can make some more substantive comments in the podcast, which the extra is about to come up. Gideon Haigh will be hanging around for that. Don't know if he knows that, but that's part of the deal. Thanks very much for coming in for the radio show, but your work's not done yet, Gideon. We'll speak to you again.
I'm not going anywhere.
Gideon Haigh's a Melbourne-based author, sports writer, journalist. He's a writer about everything. His latest book is A Scandal in Bohemia. This has been The Minefield. We'll see you next week.
I'm really hoping in the course of this podcast that we can actually get to the goal or the point, even the telos, to, you know, use the evergreen Aristotelian term, of politics. But Waleed and Gideon, in order to do that, there is something that Bill Shorten said last week in the course of his press club address that I was stunned when I heard it. I'm even more ashamed that I didn't hear it earlier and that it hasn't been commented on. I'm wondering if the two of you noted this.
This is about restoring confidence in our democratic system and our public institutions. We should treat this mission as seriously as we take national security.
That took my breath away. Mm. It's ordinary for a politician these days to bemoan the decrepitude or the lack of faith, the collapse of confidence in our public institutions. I think that's almost become commonplace. Mm. But for him to express it the way that he did and for him to put it then on par with that sacred fetish of modern political life, namely national security, that took my breath away, and not just because of what he said, but also the fact that this came at the end of a series of deliberately nonpartisan and bipartisan gestures. This is not just about Labour versus Liberal. This is not just about Shorten versus Turnbull. And what that, I guess, refreshed for me, writing at the same time as Daniel Boorstin, and then ultimately reflecting, I think, providing some of the best journalism of the post-Watergate period, was the Fleet Street expat Henry Fairley. I don't know if the two of you have ever read him. But Fairley's remark that the renewed sense of professionalism and professional disdain that Watergate had consolidated, had formed within the journalistic profession, what that effectively did is it gave journalists license to crap all over the institution, whereas he said what they had no right to do, yes, accountability, yes, to provide some, to hold politicians to their best, you know, to their best ideals, to their best selves. But he said that political journalists have no right to diminish the institution because that institution is the only thing that holds at bay the predations of the market. And so I wonder, I mean, can we say something about everything we've talked about so far presumes a certain understanding of what politics is for, that it's not just a spectator sport, but it really is for something utterly different than what mass media can, say, provide.
First, my initial response is to say that I think we've actually moved beyond that stage where journalists felt as though they were kind of crapping on things from a great height. We're not in an era where the mass media's economic model is broken. In a sense, part of the reason why we get the coverage that we do is because mass media is fighting for its life. It's preoccupied with means to kind of soothe and placate its audience, to pander to its prejudices, to throw it to red meat, to sanitise and deodorise anything that might offend its readers. It's clamouring desperately for attention amid a cacophony of noise. And the only way it often knows to respond is to produce kind of standard issue, pandering to a certain set of predictable prejudices.
This is interesting because one thing we've overlooked to this, but is related to this point, are the more economic underpinnings of this shift in our culture of politics. Mm. So, for example, we set this up by saying that we have a big economic ideological divide that has re-emerged suddenly in Australian politics, but that we're not really well adapted to talk about it and to give it the prominence it once would have had over and above more easily accessible cultural debates. At the same time, can that be divorced from changing business models of media, as you say, Gideon, but also just the changing business and industrial models that surround people's lives? For example, how do you have a political discussion about, say, wage growth or wage stagnation in an era where unions are far less significant as players in which so they can inject themselves into that conversation. What's it meant to look like to have a debate about wage stagnation when the economic and institutional mechanisms that were once so fundamental in having that debate have been defanged? I mean, we saw recently in New South Wales where there was an attempted strike on the rails, and then that was on the railways, and then that was deemed illegal, and that raises questions about well, when can you strike? What exactly does the right to strike look like? If you no longer have institutions like unions arguing over wages, then where do you? How am I, as Joe Public, say, who's worried about wage stagnation in my industry? How do I enter this? And so, what is there for me to talk about? And by what mechanism is my voice meant to be heard? On an issue like that, I may as well go back to culture. Because it seems to me that's the only thing that has the economic or business model and the technological resources that provide the platforms for me to engage politically.
Well, perhaps we haven't gone far enough in our reconsideration of the economics of the last 25 years. I mean, surely part of the explanation for Trumpism is that people's lives have changed so significantly for the worse since the experts told them that what they were undergoing was for their own good.
Yes.
You know, it's we sort of had this neoliberal prelude that's led to a kind of demagogic future. And while lots of us are sort of better off by many material measures, we feel less secure, less certain, more vulnerable. Who wants to, though, admit to being scared and wounded and emasculated? Trump turns people's anxieties into rage, which is kind of far more satisfying and far more masculine, because partly because I suspect that he's insecure in himself. I'm slightly disturbed by the fact that, you know, while Trump is a victory of an indication of a kind of a divorced public sphere, I suspect Clinton would have been as well. You know, a tainted dynast like her. Imagine had Clinton won in the same circumstances of Trump, with a minority of the popular vote but a majority in the electoral colleges. Would we be having these conversations now? Would we be brave enough to break cover?
No, because the things that would be being offended would not be the things that are easily critiqued with the tools at our disposal and with the economic and cultural logic that pervades our lives.
Yeah.
And that's why I wonder, we can talk forever about social media, but I wonder if we might be committing the same sin that we were identifying at the start of the show and not recognising that there's a huge conversation about economics to be had. Yeah.
That's right. But I think the connection here shouldn't be overlooked. I mean, one of the I've been rereading Guy Debord's Society of the Spectacle, which is achieves, it seems to me, kind of fresh currency most recently. And one of the most interesting but often overlooked aspects of his diagnosis of the culture of the spectacle is he said the spectacle is fundamentally a form of passivity that then dresses itself up. He even, in fact, uses a kind of the image almost tarts itself up as a form of empowerment. You don't see yourself as consuming passively a spectacle. You see the spectacle as giving you something, empowering you to do something that you weren't able to do previously. And that, I think, is exactly what... I mean, Trump is himself a form of passivity. He represents a form of diminished masculinity. And yet the very chest beating gives it this kind of this potency that can be intoxicating. Doesn't social media do precisely the same thing? And it just strikes me that by aping much of the same logic, so-called spectatorial politics is aiming for the same thing. It's not trying to create political agents. It's actually trying to dress up a form of fundamental emasculation, fundamental passivity, as
but
if it
I
were something
go
that
further
it's not.
Than this. That's the point. I want to go further than this. And that's why I'm reluctant to keep talking about Trump, because is that not the condition of the citizen come entrepreneur come consumer within a capitalist economy and the interaction that that has with politics? In other words, you are part of the spectacle. You are part of the sort of machine that is driven by the engines of choice, for example, and autonomy. But what you give up in that process are the means of more substantive, less spectacular engagement, right? So I mention the example of the unions only because it's so much, it's so clearly related to the conversation that our political leaders tried to kick off last week. But you could probably come up with all manner of other examples in that all you can really be within the context of an increasingly liberalised political and economic environment is a viewer, is somebody who witnesses the spectacle and gains a sense of involvement via that, because there's no other way to engage.
I'm not sure about that. I think there's a degree to which politics has become a kind of a means of personal representation.
And for the display of allegiance, citizen, or you mean for the
citizen, for right. the display of an allegiance is a kind of a social spectacle. Mm-hmm. There's arguably, to me, always been a kind of a hardcore of adamantine believers in politics. There's a far, far larger group who wonder what outward political beliefs they ought to exhibit in order to fit in. Mm-hmm. And I think we are living through an era where politics is maybe even less about conviction than about fashion. And who acts on fashion in anything other than a gestural way? And the more it seems that we talk about politics, the less we seem to be genuinely engaged.
But isn't that my point? Mm. Because this is what is left. How else are you meant to engage?
Well, providing a spectacle is a form of agency, but it's a bastardised form of agency.
Well, but you're not providing the spectacle. The spectacle has been provided to you, and then the only agency you have left is to decide whether or not you will participate in that spectacle.
Well, in fairness, though, that spectacle can be dressed up as a form of accountability, almost as a form of popular surveillance.
Well, it always is.
That's exactly right. But hang on, Gideon. I want to take up your idea about the expressive character of partisan politics, because I think that's absolutely right. This is a way of, if you like, of publicly brandishing one's allegiance and the particular causes that one stands for. Let me just go back, though, to the thing from Bill Shorten's, a little grab from Bill Shorten's press club address. Because it seems to me that there's another idea here. It's a fundamental concept of representative politics that you see bubbling up in the work of people like George Kateb or Hannah Arendt or Charles Taylor, where what politics in fact is an elaborate technology designed for the overcoming of mutual contempt. And I mean, that's in other words, partisanism is bad insofar as it legitimates and exacerbates the contempt that we have for fellow members of a political community. But where representative politics overcomes that is by gradually folding people's lives, destinies, visions for the futures into one another so that even that process of deliberation is part of the mutual regard and even civic love that we have for one another. In other words, this cannot be reduced to kind of adversarialism or tribal identification as such. It always has to have this process of sort of mutual enfolding within some kind of common vision.
Well, of course, just because people aren't participating in partisan party politics doesn't mean that they're politically uninvolved. Mm. There are many ways of making kind of political gestures or framing kind of social interactions that don't necessarily need to have a party political setting.
That's right.
In fact, if anything, probably the last 10 years has seen a drift away or a dissatisfaction with that kind of dissatisfaction with the kind of the contrivances and phoninesses of mass media, and the sense of feeling shortchanged by politics that takes place in an environment of sort of pugilistic gotcha interviews and, you know, talking head Punch and Judy shows. So I think that the maybe people have to roll their own politics. Maybe they have to be encouraged to come up with their own version that that subverts and extends the political reality to something closer to their social concerns, their immediate social concerns.
But I think that's what they're doing. So what, are they meant to do that in their spare time?
Well, yeah.
Yes. And if you do that in your spare time, what you end up with is what you've got.
Yes and no. I mean, this is where unions and union mobilization is so important. I mean, it's a way of bringing together people from vastly different castes, classes, orientations, political convictions usually, and bringing their common concerns into a particular form of deliberate, concrete action. I mean, that, I think, is what we really are missing.
And it's not. It doesn't just have to be unions either.
No,
I feel
no,
like
that's right.
that stands as a byword for a whole range of institutional arrangements. I can't even think of off the top of my head because they seem so eroded. I don't know. Maybe the church used to be that. I don't.
Sporting clubs.
Yeah.
Possibly. Yeah.
I don't know. Oh, it was interesting, actually. I mean, when were we going to get there?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean,
you have
far be it from me to bring every discussion back to cricket, but we did have an example last year of a yes. trade union that was very successful at fulfilling the ambitions of its members.
And the cricketers,
when the cricketers got together, a union. It's a small union. It's more like a craft guild in a way.
Yes. Well, even despite my best efforts, our conversations seem always to end up with sports. Thanks so much, Gideon. That's Gideon Haigh, Melbourne-based writer extraordinaire. Pretty much everything he writes, it seems to me, is well worth reading. Thanks so much for joining us on The Mindfield this week. We look forward to having your company next.